Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
The Trust and Family Hour podcast is brought to you by Casper.com. Go to Casper.com and use code word Family Hour to get $50 off your first purchase. Into the mouth of hell, I ring the wedding bell. I open the closet, what do I find? Your lingerie on my behind. Oh God, it's that time again. Tell your grandma to bring you some more sausage. Shove those waxy earbuds deep into your brain holes. Let the Skrillex of podcasting massage your thoughts and turn your fear into nanobots until you put on your mom's clothes and call your dad and let him know that you think he's rad. Rub your dog's feet. Get ready to go. It's time for the DTFH podcast show.
Hello, it is I, Duncan Trussell, the Skrillex of podcasting, and you are listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. Thank you. Thank you for listening to this podcast, and thank you all of you who came out to see the live shows last week. I can't tell you how grateful I am to you, or how grateful I am to your ancestors, or how grateful I am to the proto-hominids that your ancestors emerged from, or the mammalian creatures of the proto-hominids that your ancestors emerged from, or to the single-celled organisms that turned into multicellular organisms, that turned into mammalian creatures, that turned into the proto-hominids that grew your ancestors, that you eventually grew from. I want to thank all of those things, as well as the pre-Big Bang conditions, the top of the tree of life. I want to thank all aspects of the tree of life, and I want to thank whatever alien intelligence came up with the idea for DNA. And if it wasn't an alien intelligence, then I'd like to thank whatever programmer currently made the simulation that we are all existing in. And if it's not a simulation, then I'd like to thank the geriatric who is having a grand mal seizure from smoking too many Pall Malls and seeing flashing lights in whatever casino she happened to have gone gambling in and is currently having a hallucination within which planets and black holes and stars and podcasts exist. Whatever this stuff has sprung from, I would like to thank you for allowing me to exist in a world where people come to live shows to see me have conversations with interesting people. That makes me feel like I am in heaven. Thank you. We've got a great podcast for you today. Today's guest is Dr. Drew. We're going to dive right into it, but first, some quick business. Today's episode of the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast is brought to you by Casper.com. I don't want to be the person to remind you that the mattress you're currently laying on is one of the filthiest objects that exists, not only on this planet, but in all planets in the Milky Way. When you take your mattress cover off, it shouldn't look like a gigantic discarded tampon or something you might see in a Polaroid on Forensic Files. If you took a microscope and looked at your mattress, you'd be horrified to see that it was a seething ocean of germs, all fighting for the right to climb into your mouth at night and infect your brain with a brand new disease that's going to make AIDS and Ebola look like something that came out of a pinata at a kid's party. This is where Casper.com comes in. Okay, there's a bunch of stuff that is, it's called required talking points, so I'm going to read that, and then I'm going to tell you why I'm currently using a Casper mattress. Required talking points. An obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. Just the right sink. Just the right bounce. two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, come together for better nights and brighter days. Risk-free trial and return policy. Try sleeping on a Casper for 100 days with free delivery and painless returns. Mattresses made in America. Praise American Sniper. I said the American Sniper thing. That's not written down. $500 for a twin-size mattress and $950 for a king-size mattress. Compare that to industry averages. That's an outstanding price point. Okay, so there's that. Here's what happened. I got contacted by Casper Mattresses, and they wanted to advertise on this show. And because I don't promote anything on this show that I haven't tried, they sent me a free mattress. And I was using a very expensive mattress that I bought at a mattress warehouse when I was super stoned and wasn't thinking clearly. And I put that mattress in a different room and tried out this queen size Casper mattress and was thrilled to find that it is a very comfortable, nice mattress. And I gave my expensive mattress to a friend and am now currently using a Casper mattress as my number one mattress. So I use Casper mattresses. I know that it sucks going to buy mattresses. If you're about to move, if you're in need of a new mattress because your mattress is disgusting and every time you lay down on it, you are actually sucked backwards into a miasmic ooze made of old jam and crusted up vaginal and seminal fluids, then Casper.com is a fantastic way to go. You just go online, put in your information, and they will send you a mattress right to your door. It's in a box. You cut the box open. The mattress explodes out of the box. You try it out. If the mattress sucks, you can send the thing back. And then you can go to an expensive mattress store and get hypnotized by a mattress vendor who's going to make you feel like your choice in what mattress you're supposed to buy is the most important choice that any human being has ever made in the universe. And you're going to end up buying a super expensive mattress, and maybe you like it, but maybe you won't. But at least you'll know that you tried a Casper mattress. I have not sent mine back. I do not intend to send mine back. And I really like it a lot. Use coupon code FAMILYHOUR. And you'll get $50 towards any mattress that you buy. Support Casper. They support this podcast. Don't get ripped off by an unscrupulous mattress monger. We're also brought to you by Amazon.com. If you go through our Amazon portal located at DuncanTrussell.com, we get a small percentage of anything you buy and it doesn't cost you anything. Why fling your meat body into a metal ocean composed of cars and miserable people so that you can get to some chain store and buy things while being surrounded by toddlers who are having explosive diarrhea all over anything that their assholes happen to hover above, when you could, in the safety and general bacteria-free quiet of your home, go to Amazon.com and buy that thing and have it delivered to your house in just a couple of days, especially if you sign up for Amazon Prime. I'll never forget the time I went to buy an Xbox One game at a Toys R Us and looked over to see a toddler covered in red sores and boils, a milky eye, and a kind of body mucus dripping out of every pore in his body, landing on the floor of the Toys R Us, and I swear to God, I think I saw it sizzle, like when the alien blood touches the hull of the spaceship. This was one of the most noxious, plague-ridden toddlers I've ever seen in my life. I think he was surrounded by either a cloud of gnats or interdimensional demons who were hovering around his pestilent form, and he was shoving into his gummed mouth, into his toothless mouth, the controller of an Xbox, just sucking on this thing as though it were made of the flesh of God. Yeah, I've never seen anything so foul in my life, and I'm pretty sure that any store that you go to out there, every single surface in that store has been licked or touched or puked on or dandruffed on or just generally tainted and festered by all the disgusting, farting, bacteria-filled meat bodies that parade around these stores acting as though they are in heaven. Why not spend your time in a national forest or park, or laying in bed with your sweet lover, or tap dancing, or taking piano lessons, or going spelunking, or doing anything at all that doesn't involve riding through a metal river of cars just so that you could buy a piece of plastic while being surrounded by angry, sick people? Go through our portal located at DuncanTrussell.com. It's an Amazon portal. And when you go through that portal, you can pick anything out, literally anything. Amazon has everything. And you can have that thing delivered to your door by a nice, clean UPS man while donating to your favorite podcast without having to pay anything at all. Please bookmark the Amazon portal, won't you? And thanks to all of you guys who've been doing it. It's doing incredibly well right now, and thank you guys for using the portal. We also have a lot of great t-shirts located at DuncanTrussell.com, as well as mugs with the DTFH logo on them. The t-shirts themselves are pretty incredible. They have a sigil on there designed by Los Angeles artist Ron Rigi, and I have actually gotten emails from people who have made friends by other people who are wearing those shirts. It's not only a great way to show that you listen to this podcast, it's also a great way to terrify fundamentalist Christians who think you're wearing a satanic symbol on your shirt. And that's always fun. Wear it to Sunday school if you can. See if you can get away with it. But you could support this podcast by buying some of those shirts. I hope you'll do that. But obviously, the best way to support this podcast is just to keep listening or to come to one of the live shows. We've got a lot of live shows coming up. You can go to DuncanTrussell.com to see all those dates. I'm quickly going to go through them one more time, very quickly. April 18th in Hollywood, April 22nd in Arlington, April 23rd in Cambridge, April 24th in Philadelphia, and the 25th and 26th in Brooklyn. But those shows, unfortunately, are sold out. Get tickets now. The shows do sell out. Okay, everybody. Today's guest needs no introduction. I'm sure you know who he is. He's probably one of the most famous doctors living today. He is an addictionologist, and honestly, he's one of the sweetest people I've ever met in my life. Everybody, please open your hearts, your third eyes, and all orifices in your body to this incredible man, Dr. Drew. Dr. Drew, welcome back to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour Podcast. We're trying this again. I ruined the last one, but you're kind enough to give me another shot.
It's such a privilege. I get a total benefit because we had one full conversation. No one else gets to hear it.
Yeah.
But now we'll have another one.
Yeah. It was a really good podcast.
It was a good one. Too bad no one will hear it.
sick with depression for a little bit after that because I lost it. Man, I just have to congratulate you and applaud you for that debate with Nancy Grace. That was amazing to watch.
Tell them your analogy with the
movie. Like watching Bilbo go into the cave with Smaug. That's what it felt like. She is really, man, it really is. Don't you think she's sort of don't you think there is a potential in this that it could like fly in her face in a way maybe she doesn't expect?
Yes, because this is a topic that people have very strong feelings about. And I know she thinks she's kind of just doing television. I mean, Nancy's actually a very sweet person. She was a prosecutor, as she'll remind you a million times. And I'm sure as a prosecutor, she probably ground people down in a way without sort of listening to their arguments the way she does now.
Yes.
She doesn't listen. She just sort of grinds.
Yes.
And that's probably what she did. And then she amplifies all that for television. So it seems like, what's the name of the dragon?
Smaug.
So it seems like Smaug. But she is actually a delightful, sweet person. And I'm actually fearful that taking such a strong position that's kind of irrational and moralizing is so disconnected from the American public that you could get a big backlash.
It feels like that. And I think she's like a professional wrestler that people like to not like.
That's right.
And I get that. And I think that's it, when it comes to her sort of staunch attacks on child killers and all of that stuff. It's cool, whatever. You know, it's fun to watch. I really enjoy her. I really do enjoy her show. This position that she's taking, it stops being cute because the position that she's taking is one where that sends a lot of people to jail.
Right. Not only that, Anne impinges deeply on personal liberties for no good reason by supporting an irrational, weird law that we've had in place that I point out for you since 1937 when somebody in the government looked around and went, we got some bad people doing this bad drug. Well, who were those bad people? Well, they happen to be people with darker skin than the white folk.
Yeah.
And then they made that all illegal. And guess who we still send to jail? Same black and brown people. That's who goes to jail for pot. And that just from a social standpoint, can't we all agree? Okay, you don't like pot. Fine. From a social standpoint, can't we agree to do something about this?
Yeah, that's right. And that's why you getting into the fray with people like Nancy Grace is so important. And for you, it's a little risky. This is not a risk-free position.
Well, first of all, people don't understand my point of view. They don't. They think somehow I'm anti-pot or anti-legalization.
Right.
I'm not actually pro either. I'm pro-human liberty. I'm pro the American system. I'm pro letting the people determine their laws. I don't think this is – if I had to have a – you know, somebody press my face in the mirror and said, is it going to be good or bad – I think it might end up being kind of not so good for people, but so I'll deal with it. My profession will deal with it. That's okay. Maybe it will end up being good. I don't know.
I just tweeted somebody I like a lot. Used to be a CNN reporter named Amber Lyon. She started a website called resetme.org, which is a pro psychedelic website. And she just tweeted a study that came out showing that ODs on narcotics in Denver
are down. I know. I saw that too, and I thought, oh, this could be the answer.
Yeah.
This could be the answer to the opiate epidemic and the chronic pain thing. I would much rather see people on a lot of pot than any of the pills that they're taking out, because the pill combo that they get on, the opiate and the benzodiazepine and the sleeping medicine, A, kills. Absolutely. When patients die of drug use, that's how they die today. B, perpetuates their pain and they're disabled by it.
Yeah.
They're helpless. Pot, some people are on the couch so they smoke a lot of pot, but some people work just fine.
Well, one facet of marijuana that doesn't exist in the opiates is that if you overdose on marijuana, you don't die.
You don't die,
but you are dragged through your own personal neurosis, inner weaknesses, fears.
If you have a quote overdose.
People say, I feel paranoid.
Yeah.
And usually what they mean is the marijuana is showing all these parts of myself that I don't necessarily want to deal with right now. And that can create a lot of positive change for people. Now, not all the time. A lot of times I've definitely have been paranoid and the things I've worried about are ridiculous and absurd. And when I sober up, I recognize that. But a lot of times some of the stuff I'm shown on a heavy dose of marijuana, I come out of that knowing, shit, man, I've got to work on this. Why am I not exercising? I need to exercise more. This is ridiculous. I'm drinking a little too much right now. I need to slow down drinking. On the last podcast, did I talk to you about how I almost died on Valium years and years and years ago? Oh, God. Oh, man. There was a guy came to this party I was at selling Valium. It, like, 12 p.m. at a party, the worst thing you could ever do, Valium when everyone's already kind of
drunk.
Everybody,
get in your cars now. Go home.
Yeah, and this was...
And how much you been drinking? Oh, perfect. Good combo.
And I bought some from him. I don't even know why I would do that. I'm well aware of the fact that you should never, ever, ever in a million years ever take Valium and drink. Never do it. It's what kills everybody. This is the death combo.
Yeah, it is.
So I did it, and I remember...
One of the death combos.
I think I took one Valium, and then I'm drinking and like feeling relaxed, but I forgot I'd taken a Valium.
This is the danger of the benzos.
This is how it kills you.
Yeah, you forget. Yeah.
And then I took another.
Another one does that. You forget.
Yeah.
By the way, not bad. I let me just clarify my thing too. I hate this idea of good drugs and bad drugs. There's no such thing as a good drug and a bad drug. There's this chemical that's neither good nor bad. It just exists out there. We either created it or exist in nature. And then it's the relationship that humans have with the substance that is the issue.
So smart.
What our individual biology is and what it triggers and whatnot. That's the problem. Like Valium, if you're need to have a colonoscopy, Valium and Valium Light drugs,
great.
Really good. If you're just drinking absinthe and partying and about to drive home, really bad.
Death.
Not because Valium's good or bad, because the circumstance and the relationship is bad.
I'll never forget it, man. I was laying in bed that night trying to remember how many of the pills I had taken as I'm passing out.
God.
As I'm passing out. And then I realized, oh, I can't move. Like I'm. If I wanted to get up right now, I don't think that I could get up. And this is as I'm fading out into darkness.
Geez.
And then I woke up the next day. Thank God, and I was alive. But if I had vomited,
that's it.
I would have died.
That's how they die.
Yeah,
that's it.
I have a friend who died.
It's called aspiration pneumonia. You don't have to vomit a lot either. Sometimes it just be reflux. Sometimes it can just be a little saliva. And it goes down the wrong tube, gets into your lungs, and all the bacteria that's in your mouth goes into your lungs where it don't belong. You set up a pneumonia, become septic, you go into shock, and you die in about 30 minutes, 60 minutes. It can happen fast.
My God. Yeah, I had a friend. The comedian who got me into stand-up comedy died of a drug overdose. He died of...
Ooh, you mind saying?
Freddie Soto was his name. Mm. Really funny comic. He was like, things were going great for him too. He was like hitting his stride, having all this moment. He was about to get his own show, and he took some pills, went out drinking, slept on his friend's couch. His friend came out the next morning, and Freddie Soto had left the casino, and we were all just we still are heartbroken by that. But those things are evil. Yeah. Evil, 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 evil.
It's evil in that situation.
Now I'm Nancy Grace.
In that situation. It's not the chemical. The chemical is just a thing of nature.
Dr. Drew, you're so cool, man. This stance that you have is the smartest one to take, which is like we can't apply morality to these inorganic substances.
Right. It's not
moral. Organic.
People do, on certain chemicals, will do immoral things.
Right.
Not because the substance is immoral.
Right.
It's not. It's just right. The substance is the substance. That's all.
Yeah, and that's what I like about the way you teach is because you are not just anti-addiction. It feels like you're anti-victim because by removing the
I'm anti-human suffering. I'm anti-hurting people. And what's interesting to me, I'm clarifying our sort of back and forth too because I tweeted this. I know you saw it the other day that I love being around people that help me see the world through a new pair of glasses, and you're one of those people.
Thank you.
And so I'm open to all the stuff you say, and I think it's fascinating. And then I go, but you could hurt somebody. You notice that? I'm always like, but what if? And we were Duncan was on my KBC radio program a few minutes ago with Mike Catherwood, and we talked about pumping mushrooms into horrible world leaders.
Yeah.
and Duncan goes, look, he'd have insight, which was going to be the North Korean leader.
Yeah, that's right.
And we said he'd get insight and he'd be happy and he'd realize what he was doing. And I thought, or he'd go darker and he'd get horrible and he'd get suicide. Who knows?
We don't know. That's true.
It's the or that always, because I, as a physician, you get to see all the unintended biological situations.
That's right. Yeah, that's the thing, man. And you guys do see these things that a lot of us don't see. But
yeah.
I think that... and I think it's so important to balance out, to find the middle path in between the both of these perspectives, the Nancy Grace perspective, and then the perspective of the person who thinks that marijuana is the ultimate remedy for all ailments.
Right, because both are extreme and sort of they're ideological rather than assessing. One of my favorite statements is, health is about accepting and perceiving and dealing with reality on reality's terms. Right. Now, you said something in our last pod that no one heard that stayed with me, which was the analogy of the elevator and hallucinogens.
Yes.
Do you use that often or was that?
Well, that is actually that analogy is I believe that came from Ram Dass, that was the analogy he gave because Alpert, if anybody was Ram Dass, Richard Alpert, pals with Timothy Leary, great documentary coming out about those two. In a few months, actually, being released by Timothy Leary's son, Zach Leary. But anyway, Ram Dass, huge psychedelic advocate, along with Timothy Leary. But then they began to experience this frustration, which was that all the information that they were getting in those super heightened states of consciousness was sort of trickling out of their brains like water out of a bucket with a hole in it. They weren't able to hold on to it all.
I had said to you, these insights might be great, but do they really change anything? I think that's what prompted your analogy or your metaphor.
Which is so the metaphor is that it's compared to an elevator that takes you up to the very top floor of this building where this incredible party is happening. The doors open up. You see this amazing utopian nirvanic
situation.
You never
really knew it was there. You never seen it before.
Never even knew it was there. And then the elevator, the thing dings, the doors shut. It comes back down, and suddenly you're screaming at people in traffic again. And that's the problem, is that...
And so that's an analogy for what hallucinogens do.
That's right.
And this is, again, my contribution as I went, yeah, but what if it doesn't let you off on the first floor and ends up two floors into the basement?
Taking you lower.
As the doctor in me always worries about that.
Yeah, and let's say that it does take you lower. Let's say that you get to go up in a hot air balloon and see the very top of some beautiful mountain, and then the hot air balloon gets blown off course a little bit. You've still seen the top of the mountain, and I think that...
There's the independent value of that.
There's an independent value.
Despite the risk. And then I ask the question, so how do we get there in a way that we're in control over, we can stay there?
Yeah, that's the big question.
Yeah.
I think it's a lot of things. I think, I am right now really into this type of Buddhism called Vipassana or insight meditation, which is just the process of sitting still, watching your breath, and being very aware of your thoughts, emotions, and the way your body feels. And it's just this... something called mindfulness. It's the practice of mindfulness, which is just watching the way that you act and the way that you feel and the way that you think, and becoming aware of the roots of a lot of the emotions that exist in you. Especially for me, like, I get angry and I will have like angry outbursts sometimes. And thank you for looking perplexed that happens. It happens.
Just sitting by yourself, anger will come out, or is it like traffic?
Well, no, traffic, it's gotten much better. But I mean, when I was much younger, I was just an angry person. So I would I can remember my printer didn't work one day, and I remember screaming alone in my apartment, breaking my printer and just a rage. And that's a thing that's inside of me. And that's why psychedelics have been very useful to me. But also insight meditation has been incredibly useful, because now I can sit and I can meditate, and then maybe the dogs will bark, right, while I'm meditating. And then I can watch the irritation sort of flower inside of me. And then when it's there, in insight meditation, they say, look at it as though you're sitting in a forest and you're getting to watch a rare animal walking out into a clearing. And instead of, you know, as most of us do when anger comes in, we react to it. We go into reactivity mode, which is like maybe you would stop meditating and scream at your dogs, or you would do something to like make them
so
quiet.
A behavior that amplifies it, really.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's it. So you just watch. The Buddha compares anger to a sweet flower with bitter roots, and
ew.
So we follow the sweetness down into the poisonous roots of the thing.
Do you do that in a kind of feeling way or in an insight way, if that makes sense? In other words, you just follow the feelings, or do you have some sort of specific, oh, that reminds me of some experience or some?
Well, it's called noting, is what they, so you would, you can, what, you know, it's like, it's just, think about an emotion,
yeah,
right? These are these really kind of ambiguous.
Yeah, these bodily-based things you're faintly aware of many times.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So it's, what is that thing, right?
Yeah.
So this is the practice of taking a microscope and looking into the recurring emotional patterns that are happening inside of you, and really starting to see, because most of the time, if you have a negative emotion, you'll try to avoid it. That's when the phone comes out, or that's when you try to move on to the next activity when some kind of emotional state. We are always in a state of trying to turn our backs on the thing. What happens if we don't turn our backs and zoom in on the thing and see what is this fractal? And it's really an interesting practice, because you start getting deeper into the thing, and it's like you can visualize what it might look like. You can see it as a color or a form or a shape. And just, but in Buddhism, the idea is all of those mental forms of analysis of these things are kind of secondary to the very simple observation of the way any emotional state or thought or bodily feeling has a similar pattern, in that it emerges, heightens, dissipates, and goes away.
You know, this is the zone that so much neurobiology and mental health research is going these days. We talked about this a little bit in the Lost podcast, the Unknown podcast. But for me, a lot of that magical stuff you're talking about happens in an interpersonal context. I'm a kind of person that it's very difficult for me to stay with some of those things unless there's a presence or even a back and forth. Maybe it's an amplification or a regulation or something. So to me, I put a lot of emphasis in that space of the, I think, the magic. You know, I'm sort of, there's a philosopher that was Buber, big on this. He felt that God existed between people.
Yeah.
That was the magic. But they are also people like you that, you know, you say mindfulness, that's a massive field these days. And most people practice it, don't do it as well as what you're describing, frankly.
Well, what you're saying, though, is a big part of the practice, too. You're talking about the Sangha, the spiritual community, which is acknowledged in Buddhism, too, and is considered to be as important as meditation. It's the kind of the transference of information that comes between people who are seeking the truth. Because Buddhism, who cares about Buddhism, or who cares about this religion or that religion? What's important is let's encourage each other to get as close to the truth as we can, or as you mentioned earlier, to meeting reality on reality's terms. Let's get to that together.
People tolerate that. I'm the kind of person, I experience myself others first, and or before I experience my, I was thinking about this the other day when we were doing radio. I was thinking, I don't spontaneously come up with much, but when there's another person, I experience myself very vividly. You know, I really, does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. Especially when you resonate with somebody, because that's, you know, you go from, you know, it's the term gestalt. You've heard that term. So it's that thing, which is that other thing comes into the room.
That's right. And it's, we now think of it as the right brain. I mean, some people think of it that way, as this holistic, some non-rational, non-verbal, bodily-based, resonant thing that exists between us, and, you know, two brains relating. I think I told you last time, I think that's where consciousness comes from. I don't think feral children have consciousness in the way we think of consciousness.
Yeah.
I think consciousness emerges in a matrix with other humans.
Wow.
And then you can do something with it by yourself. But really, the consciousness, if what I've read and seen of feral children, no sense conscious in a way I understand. They have thoughts and they have feelings and emotions and behaviors that emerge from motivations, but I don't get a sense that they're conscious until they enter with other people, and then they sort of develop a little consciousness.
Wow.
It's not as good as if they were born into it, but they get some.
Yeah, that kind of, I can see that kind of makes sense. You need, well, I mean, clearly, I mean, look at us.
Just language, even. I mean, you need that. You need other people to shape that for you.
We need other people. And,
yeah.
And isolationism usually can't lead anywhere. It's the whole idea. But, you know, one thing to think about if you're someone who, the way that you find this truth or the way that you do your spiritual practice is through interaction with other people, is because that's dualism, right? You need another person in the room, right?
Yeah.
So now we're in dualism. But then if you think about it, if you just sit by yourself and you just sort of watch yourself, you're already weirdly with another person,
the Hindus call it the Purusha or Purushka.
Right?
Isn't that there's an inner observer?
Well, my understanding of that is there's something called Prakriti, and there's something I think by the way, I will butcher these terms, and I've been on a rampage of saying like things that are completely off lately on this podcast, so I'll mess it up. But
do people like write you and tell you to straighten you out?
Oh, every time.
Experts.
It's humiliating too, because like it's already too late to change it. Like,
but it's good. You refine your expertise.
And I acknowledge it as long as you just acknowledge, like, I was completely wrong about that. So
they know where you're going anyway. Yeah.
Generally know the idea. But so there's something called Prakriti and there's something called Purusha. So the idea is that this is a kind of, in Buddhism, it's called, something like spontaneous co-arising. But Prakriti, I believe, is the term for all of inorganic matter, the material world, flesh, body, every single thing is Prakriti. Purusha would be the field of consciousness.
It's a spiritual world.
What's called the observer state.
Yeah, yeah.
So in other words, like here we have this inorganic material, everything that is...
Not inorganic, because we're organic.
We're organic.
Yeah.
So, but we're still, we go back to the earth, right?
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
The way to put it
we're
is...
We're physical.
Right,
yeah.
Physical. So we're trying to do this process where we sort of keep going backwards until we can't look at ourselves anymore. So we want to go to this
a complete observer state
yes.
through all these varieties of spiritual practices until you get to the thing that can't turn around and look
it's
at
like
it.
It's like your awareness of awareness.
That's it.
Yeah.
And then you become pure awareness.
Yeah.
And the concept is that is what we really are.
Yeah.
And that this entire material universe, including our bodies, is a kind of phenomenological field of phenomena being encapsulated within this consciousness. And so when the idea that I am alone or the idea that I am an individual is actually, interestingly enough, you're already not an individual anymore. It's false.
It's a distortion.
Because you're the thing and the observer simultaneously meeting together, and that's what creates the illusion of self. And the process of Buddhism and a lot of spiritual practices is to dissolve that illusion and merge back into
that. And you feel shit like this when you're high on acid?
Yes, you do.
You feel it, but you don't think it, right?
I think you feel it and you do think it. I think that if in lower doses of acid, you're going to be more prone to think it. And in higher doses of acid, you're going to be more prone to feel it. And definitely there's a merging that happens at higher doses of LSD and a lot of psychedelics that, you know, in fact, some people say one problem when people have really bad trips, weirdly, is that they haven't taken enough of the hallucinogen.
Ugh.
And they're still in the
makes
liminal.
Me nervous.
It should make you nervous. I love it. I think it's really important to, you know, man, when I was younger, doing podcasts or just talking to people, I was really gung-ho about the whole thing and just sort of like, ah, everyone just do it. It'll be fine.
Right, but because, again, you took a ideological point of view.
Yes.
Like, you're not the boss of me, man. We're going to do this cool thing.
Yeah.
Go do it, but know your risk. Know what it is. Really know what it is.
And that's why we need people like you. That's why people like you are so important, because it grounds. It's finding this, like, grounding place in between the mad raving of Nancy Grace and the mad raving of the guys
super...
who are just everyone do it. I'll put it in your coffee.
Yeah.
Even though I think those guys, that might be a kind of I can't think of when I've really run into anybody like that. Most people I know are
Timothy Leary was a little that way.
Timothy Leary.
I met him.
No way.
Swear to God. He was on Loveline, of all the things.
What?
Can you imagine? Yeah. I can't remember when it was, probably in the early 90s, probably. It might have been late 80s.
Wow.
And he was old.
Yeah.
He seemed impaired in some interesting way. He couldn't, like, put headphones on his head. He couldn't figure out how to do it. It was really interesting. but intellectually and command of language and all that kind of stuff seemed, like, remarkable. And he talked to me about how he had developed the actual phenomenon of group therapy. That he wrote the original papers for, I think he's at Stanford or Cal, on what this new phenomenon, he called it group therapy.
Wow.
He sort of invented it with some other guy.
Not surprising, he invented a lot of stuff.
He was a super bright guy.
Super
nice.
Yeah.
Super nice dude.
Yeah. I
think his son may have been with him that day.
Zach.
I have a faint feeling memory that something like that was going on.
Well, he's incredibly misunderstood, and he's mostly known for. And I think one of his frustrations when he was in prison
was he in prison for
marijuana possession of marijuana.
How pathetic is that?
But that was not why he was in prison. He was in prison because he was going around telling everyone tune in, turn on, drop out.
Oh.
He was because here's what happened: really, really smart people came into contact with this substance. LSD, and really, really smart people, when they come into contact with this substance, they realize that they are suddenly being given access to a part of their consciousness that formerly was completely unavailable to them. So if these really smart people happen to be psychologists, because there's no stigma against it this time, it's just a drug that Hoffman discovered in Sweden at Sandoz Laboratories, and it was a drug that seem to have a lot of potential for studying psychosis. If we can make ourselves schizophrenic, that's what they thought at first. If we can put ourselves into this state of what, at first they thought, is this what schizophrenics experience? Then we can understand how to treat schizophrenia. We can understand how to treat this stuff. But the more that they began to ingest the substance, the more they began to realize, oh, this isn't schizophrenia at all. This is actually taking me into a part of my subconscious that seems to be the storehouse of all mythological symbols that have ever existed the fountain from which all language emerges.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because you started to talk about your cell phone before we got on the pod here. The elephant on your phone.
Oh, Ganesh.
And I wanted to talk a little bit about mythology. Is it time to go there?
Yeah, let's do it.
Tell them the story of the elephant.
Okay, so I'm going to butcher. I think everything that involves me referring to something in the past or a movie or book, I'll just say I'm probably wrong, so look it up. But Ganesh is the son of Shiva, and he was, according to myth, he was positioned to guard his mother's palace. And so he's standing at the gates of his mother's palace, and Shiva, I guess, came home and said, "Hey, I'm go, you know, step aside, son." And he's like, "I can't. She told me not to let anyone in." And so Shiva, being the god of destruction, the final fate, he represents, you know, the Hindu trinity, Brahman, Vishnu, Shiva. He represents the annihilation that inevitably happens to all things in the universe. That's the elemental force he represents. And so he just decapitates his son. And of course, his wife is like, "What the fuck is wrong with you? You just killed our kid." And he's like, "Oh, relax." He takes an elephant head and places it onto his son's neck. And that's Ganesh. That's why Ganesh has an elephant head. And Ganesh is the remover of obstacles. Good fortune. Ganesh can shrink himself down right around on a mouse. There's a lot of incredible aspects of the story of Ganesh.
But see, I believe that so many of these myths, aside from the fact that they have symbolic veracity, in other words, like there's negative forces and positive forces, but the form they take, it's got to say something about how our brains work.
That's right.
You know what I mean? And just the idea of a father wanting to cut a son's head off, I mean, that's got to be in us somewhere. That's why these myths sustain, right?
Yeah.
They're relatable, and they came out of us, these myths, right?
Yes.
They came out of us. And I think even like the Greek myths, I think back in that day, they were so kind of primitive in terms of their emotional understanding. They felt that emotions came from the outside in, and that the gods, each one of those gods sort of represented a different emotion in a weird way. And that, like, that particularly like Athena and stuff, she'd always make people want to fuck. she'd show up and go, "Uh-oh, I want to fuck somebody's wife. Uh-oh, Athena's
cool.
making me do it.
Cool.
It's her fault, not mine."
Awesome.
Because it was this weird sort of, and children think that way too, like emotions come from the outside.
And I
think about an elephant head. I mean, in a weird way, babies kind of look, baby elephant heads and baby human in a weird way. I mean, I could see if you were on an acid trip, they would kind of weirdly look right? Weirdly.
Yeah.
And so, and then probably the Indians had all kinds of interesting experiences with elephants, probably as kids, as being helpful and loving and all this stuff. I could see where they could kind of, in a dream sort of thing, sort of mesh these things, right?
Absolutely.
And so I think it's all this weird shit that flies around in our head that you love messing with.
Yes, I do.
And I think that's sort of where myth, I think about Isis and Osiris, you know, the Egyptian myth.
Yeah, can you talk about that a little bit?
It's so bizarre. All I remember is like, you know, the sister, somebody cuts the brother's penis off and then puts him in a column, and the sister goes to the ends of the earth to find the penis and finds it in the water or something and puts it back together, except it's not his penis. It's just all this weird penis stuff with the sister and the brother.
A lot of penis stuff everywhere, scattered throughout myth.
Right, and Egypt, really. I mean, a lot, the British sort of whitewashed a lot of it, what they found, because it didn't meet Victorian standards. But they kind of suppressed a lot of how crazy genital it was all based.
Yeah.
But that's got to be somewhere.
Well, it's cool you mentioned that, because in Shaivism, there is the worship of the lingam. And so there's all these like phalluses that I think represent the cock of Shiva that people worship.
Yeah.
Which, why wouldn't you? You know, because the cock is the place from which human existence initially emerges from on this planet before it like fuses with
the female.
Yeah, that's right. So it is the whole Victorian sentiment where we're terrified of the precursors to human life.
Yeah.
It's very strange.
And, right.
You know, you know about Carl Jung, of course,
yes,
I'm sure.
Yes.
So yeah, he
sort of was in this zone all the time, right?
Always in that zone.
And I don't really dig the archetype thing. It doesn't help me. It doesn't, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I agree with them. They're sort of out there.
Yeah.
But you kind of keep breaking it down and breaking it down and breaking it down. And it becomes this sort of endless intellectual puzzle for me, as opposed to the feelings connected to these crazy archetypes.
Right.
That interests me. And I would think that in your that your drugs would connect you to some of that too, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And especially, you know, one thing I've talked about in the podcast is my first real encounter with Christianity happened when I was taking LSD and reading the New Testament when I was in college. I took some acid.
Did you go to college?
Warren Wilson College in Asheville, North Carolina, liberal arts school, 600 students, great school. But yeah, I was on acid, reading the Book of John.
Oh, Jesus.
And you know, one of the great benefits of LSD is it strips away a lot of your expectations, or a lot of it kind of cleanses the subjective lens that you're looking at
the structure.
The structure of things. So you can kind of look at things for the first time,
yeah.
even though you've seen it your entire life. The Bible, of course.
See, I would say you're looking at it through your right brain, your right holistic, sort of more bodily based, connected.
Yeah.
I
think that's, I would say that if they were to do scans of the brain, I bet they would find that.
Yeah, or whatever that equivalent is in the brain. Yeah,
but that's an important, that's a really important thing, because so many times we're all staring at our lives through a kind of polluted, a kind of window that is smudged with all of our ideas of how things work.
Did you see that TED talk with the neuroscientist who had a bleed in the left side of her brain? And
I did, but can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, basically, she you know, understands the brain profoundly, and she was in the shower one morning and had a intracranial bleed, we call it, or parenchymal bleed, and that sort of shut down the left side of her brain. And she talks about, with the right side now operating without the left, how she tried to hold her hand out because she felt herself sort of falling over, and she felt like her hand went like through the shower, and the shower sort of dissolved. It sounded like an acid trip is what it sounded like.
Yeah. I mean,
that everything sort of became one, but there was some joy and sort of holistic warmth that she was connected to in those moments.
Yeah.
I can't do it any justice. I only heard it once, but I remember being deeply I forget her name. Jeez. Maybe you can put it up
easy.
Later with
this podcast. Easy, I can put it up. Yeah. I'll put the link up. Yeah.
It's worth your time. It's a relatively short podcast, and she's not the kind of person to drift into this kind of a conversation. You can tell she's very rigid and intellectual and scientific, but boy, she can bring beauty to this description, and she's just urging us all to think more about that part of our experience. I mean, she's not saying do drugs or don't do drugs. She's not saying meditate or don't meditate. She's saying this is a part of our human experience, and this is my thing, that we just are not connected to, and we're missing a lot because we're not. And I don't claim to have all the answers to anything. Like I said, you've helped me see things through a new pair. I'm open. I'm listening. It worries me, your way of doing it. I'm good, sir. I'm fear. It scares the shit out of me. Now that I care about you, it scares me
more. Thank you.
You know, but I'm open. I'm listening.
You don't have to worry too much, because if I ever take a psychedelic, I am very responsible about doing it.
It's a cumulative effect I'm worried about.
Oh,
I want us to grow old together.
I'll talk to you. Yeah. Oh, how sweet.
I saw Timothy O'Leary. It wasn't so pretty.
Timothy.
He took a lot, though.
But we don't. Yeah, he took a lot, and we don't know what other drugs he was taking, and we don't know. It's really important to take a look at Albert Hoffman, you know, because he lived till I think he was 90 when he passed away. Or take a look at Aldous Huxley, who wrote a prescription for intravenous LSD on his deathbed as he was dying to his wife.
How interesting.
There's a lot of examples of people who aren't necessarily burnt out, or who seem relatively okay.
Yeah. Or even if they're not, if they're a little bit not okay, maybe it was worth it.
Maybe
this
it was
is
worth
the part
it.
I don't know.
You know, a lot of elderly people that I've run into who have taken no psychedelic in their lives don't seem to like they're doing that great.
No, they're not okay. That's right.
Yeah.
No, look, and you know, I'm a workaholic, and you know, I'm not a perfect person. We're all just trying to get through this thing. And I like to help, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think that's an important, to me, this back to that interpersonal thing. I'd like to think in terms of the good life, what makes a good life, and part of that is service and other people and making a difference. But you're making a difference too by trying to struggle with these important issues that I say we don't pay enough attention to.
We don't pay enough attention to. And I think we're in a kind of beautiful age right now, because the prohibition's being lifted a little bit. The statistics are coming out and showing that there are definite or seemingly definite benefits to these substances. And my interaction with the Ram Dass people and my meditation practice. And
is this thing still working?
It's still
makes
working.
Me nervous.
I'm watching it. We haven't lost this.
Good.
It's
because this is good.
It really One thing that there's a story that Ram Dass tells where when he came back to the United States, you know, some hippies saw him and they saw he had this big beard. He's probably wearing robes or something. He at the time he was dressing like a renunciant brahmachari, as it's called. And some hippies saw him and they, you know, offset asked him if he could get them any drugs.
Right.
And his response was, I can teach you a process that will get you a million times higher than anything you've ever experienced. And they're like, bullshit.
Yeah.
No way. But the more that I keep up a consistent meditation practice and the more that I keep up consistently studying Buddhism and the process that is offered by certain schools of Buddhism, the more I realize, oh, God, he was right. This stuff is way stronger than acid, way stronger than any
psychedelic. And it's yours. You own it.
That's right.
Yeah, that's what I like. I always worry about things coming easy or free in nature.
Right.
There's always a hidden cost. And unless you do the hard work, there's a cost.
Well, but here's the thing. You know that in the substance, one of the most hallucinogenic substances on the planet is dimethyltryptamine, which is an endogenous chemical. It
DMT.
Already exists. That's right. DMT exists in the human brain. It's already inside of both of us right now. Our brains have DMT inside of us. And that's why when you ingest it, especially when you smoke it, trip lasts for about 11 minutes, and it's the most powerful hallucinogenic trip.
Have you done that one?
Yes, I have.
Is it crazy?
Well, yes, it is. What happened to me was, this is a really weird thing, man. Yeah. What happened to me was, I had for, God, probably a decade, 9 years, 8 years, maybe a decade, had a kind of persistent pain right here in my chest, right here. Been to the doctor about it. Then when I got cancer, I was getting, CAT scans checked, Jesus. Chest x-rays. Yeah. Everything
I always
was...
forget about that with you. Jesus Christ.
It stinks.
Yeah.
You know that. You've been down that road.
I like to forget mine too.
And you should. Once you've gone through it, you've gone through it. But this pain, man, I don't know what it was, but it was a real bummer. And it was always there. And so I smoked DMT. And these tubes, like these microtubules, seemed to kind of come out of nowhere, connected directly to this place that had been hurting so much. There's this sense, not a voice in your head, but a sense of something inviting me, or I'm going to say it said this, but it's not like it said it.
Yeah,
but it was,
you understood it too.
Understood it to say, just accept this, just accept this, just accept this, accept this love. This is love. This is love. And it just feels like love is getting pumped into me from some other place. And then from that experience, I can't explain it. It was being in a kind of, I don't know, a place of the most beautiful peace and incredible geometries that were sort of unfolding. A sense of being drawn into a tunnel that was like a curve that I couldn't quite get around, a feeling of familiarity with the place, and then suddenly you've come down, and after that we went to eat lunch, and I'm realizing that this blissful sort of euphoric feeling is increasing in me. And it's based on information that I was given that I could no longer remember. So the way I describe it is, it's like somebody whispered really good news into my ear.
Yeah.
And then I couldn't remember what the good news was.
Like a dream, kind of.
Yeah, that's what it's like. But since then, that pain, gone. Gone.
Never came back.
It comes every once in a while. I'll feel it a little bit.
Did your mood crash on the other side of the euphoria at all?
That's what's crazy about DMT is that no crash, man. Wow. No crash. It's just a kind of...
Does the pain ever come back with depression?
Yeah. Yeah, it does. When I'm stressed out, or when I'm angry, or when I it's depression, man. It was some kind of, what would you call that? There's a term for that kind of physical.
Globus is the term of a fist in your chest. It's called globus. It's actually got a name.
No shit.
Yeah, it's kind of an anxiety symptom more than depression, but it kind of goes together. And I believe anxiety is a disconnectedness. It's interesting that my own experience of anxiety was just emptiness and disconnected from self and other.
Globus,
yes.
Didn't even know there was a word
usually
for
it. Usually it goes up into the neck. That's sort of where we usually feel it.
Wow.
But
Globus. I had Globus.
I think you probably did.
DMT cured my Globus.
Another use for DMT.
Yeah. Yeah. That's cool, man. I had no idea that was. Now, you've had. So you've had to struggle with anxiety. We've talked about that.
Horrible, horrible.
Yeah.
Just most of my young adult life and with panic. The panic was the horrible part.
Nothing worse,
and
huh?
Then, And I always worried, you know, there's a lot of shitty pot around when I was in college, and people were always pushing up and smoking.
Yeah.
And I wondered if that ever contributed to the panic or the anxiety, because it can do that. It can do that. It certainly didn't help.
Not me.
And I didn't like it. That's sort of good news to me. It's like when I like something, that's not good news.
Right.
But that doesn't mean, you know, other people are clearly having a different biology when they really do. That's good for them.
I've always been mystified by that stoner, when stoners like, it helps you relax. That's never been my experience.
No, I get panicky and irritable. I get jittery, if anything. But my panic did follow in the heels of using some of that. I wondered if that had something to do with it always. But be that as it may, it was paralytic panic. And then I was managed horribly for a couple of years, so that the panic became, there's this horrible background anxiety. I ground through that, I don't know.
Yeah.
And I was depressed, and I didn't know where I was going in life, and didn't know who I was. Well, the usual 18 to 22 bullshit. I was deep into it.
18 to 22?
Well.
Shit.
But I mean, that's really when you were, right. What am I going to make a living? What am I going to do? Who am I?
Right.
You know, I want my mommy.
Yeah.
Which direction to go, forward or back?
When did you become... Dr. Drew, when did you become the world-famous celebrity doctor? When did that happen?
It's interesting that I don't think of myself that way, but I started doing, you know what's, I was thinking about this when I was in the bathroom just a couple minutes ago, is that I've spent most of my life being very serious about very serious work. I mean, like,
yeah.
I almost had three medical careers rolled into one. I was, you know, running an addiction program. I was running a medical service in a psychiatric hospital. I was doing critical care and running a general medical practice for a couple decades. And I was very serious about it. I mean, I really loved it. Although I did so much of it, I would dread it at times. Like, that's my workaholism.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was such important. I thought it was like, I don't know, almost sacred work I was doing. But almost too much. I was almost too protective. Like, my dad was a doctor, my uncle's. I was too invested in it personally. And my outlet started when I was in medical school. I was invited to come on a radio show, and it was Loveline back then. And I just thought, oh my God, these kids are calling with this stuff, and they don't know about this thing called GRIDS, gay-related intestinal disease syndrome, that you now know as AIDS. No one was talking about it, and no one was talking to young people about the biological reality of their sexual choices. And I knew, you know, no one really knew what adolescents were doing in the 1980s. It was adults, after the sexual revolution, adults had sex. They never imagined that adolescents had sex.
Wow.
It was never contemplated. Well, of course, adolescents do whatever. As soon as you say it's game on, it's game on. And I knew that because I'd just come through adolescence. And I just thought it was important. So for about 10 years, I just did it once a week. I thought I was doing community service. It was fun. It was interesting. I'd meet, you know, people coming into K-Rock, rock stars and things like that.
Yeah.
My social life. I met my wife there. I mean, that was my social life. One day a week, I got to go do something interesting and cool and creative. But the rest of the time, I was very, very serious about what I did. Then all of a sudden in the mid-90s, a couple of television, and I'm doing air quotes with that, producers showed up because I didn't know what that meant even. And what the fuck do I know about that television?
Right.
We're going to make a TV show out of your radio show, which was that by then starting to go five nights a week, and it was getting a little more momentum. And through a whole series of, frankly, mishaps, Corolla gets inserted in there, and we do this thing on MTV, and it becomes very popular, and then the radio show becomes popular. And I was just sort of still sort of doing that on the DL as I saw it. I mean, that's why I never even used my last name. I didn't want people to think of me. There was Dr. Pinsky, which was practicing medicine. And there was Dr. Drew that did this creative, interesting thing to try to help change the culture is what I thought I was doing. Because I thought radio had such a powerful effect on culture, not so good, that maybe we could infuse a little reality, reality's terms. And then a couple guys turned up years later. I guess I was just doing radio at the time, and I guess I was doing news commentary on drugs and alcohol then, because I was doing a lot of that in my clinical practice. guys showed up and they had this idea to do a celebrity rehab. And I was like, that would be fantastic to get people to understand how sick some of these celebrities are. Yeah. Oh, I'd written a book, I think, around that time about celebrities and narcissism and stuff. And
what's the name of that book?
The Mirror Effect, which is sort of this concept we invented to explain how people responding to celebrity narcissism. And and they wanted to do this show, and I thought, well, it'd be great to show how treatment is done and how sick celebrities are, but there's no way you're going to do this. This is ridiculous.
Right.
How could you possibly do treatment on TV? And they kept going at me. And one day, Bob Forrest came into my office. You know Bob, the guy with the hat and the glasses?
Yes.
He came to my office and he said, he just sat down all of a sudden in my office and said, we got to do a television show where we show how hard this work is. We got to get the word out about how addiction treatment works and it's not a spa vacation. We were treating a fair number of celebrities then. He was like, these people are sick. They're being maligned in the press. We got to show. And I said, weird. Somebody has been approaching me about this. If you, Bob, really think this is a good idea, I'll start to move it forward a little bit. And that's sort of where that happened. And that's, I think, where I kind of entered the more public consciousness right about then.
Yep, that's it, man. Yeah. That is, and I love the angle of, like, I think if you are going to find the peak of what it looks like, the just a true shit maelstrom, find somebody who's famous, has got a lot of resources, and is addicted to some substance. Oh God,
it's bad.
Oh God, it is so horrible.
And yeah,
but what's really scary about it? This is something I find to be really dark and sinister.
Tell
is
me.
The way that they are slowly being murdered by their friends. Like there's this
friends again, air quotes.
You know what I'm talking about?
Oh yeah.
And also trying to meet the expectation of being this person that they created. There's this awful negative support system. Like
yep.
I went to see Elliot Smith perform live, and this was, apparently he cleaned himself up before his suicide. But
that happens a lot.
This was before he cleaned himself up.
No.
And so he came out to perform, and he couldn't stand up. He had to have a chair because he couldn't stand up. So he's sitting in a chair. He seems he's having a real hard time putting sentences together. But every time he stumbled or every time he did something that was clearly a drug-related fuck-up, the audience would cheer, like, yeah, yeah, he's dying. Look, he's really dying right here in front of us. And that, it was just chilling because
yeah.
It's like, oh, this is sacrifice. Yeah. We're watching
yes.
human sacrifice
oh,
happen
absolutely.
Here.
Absolutely. Human sacrifice is alive and well, dude. Have we ever talked about this?
No.
I believe that's a deep, we don't like to look at it, but I think that's still a deeply human impulse. I think look at the one that galvanized the whole world, the guy on the cross.
Yeah.
We don't have to kill anymore because we got that guy.
No.
That guy's dead.
Yeah.
We killed that one.
Yeah.
We're all good now. We're all together looking at him.
Right.
It's really a thing where it galvanizes people together, and I think it regulates our aggression against one another by focusing
Whoa.
On one.
One.
Right?
And that one,
we throw them off the volcano, we tear their heart out up on the temple, whatever we got to do.
We catch them at the airport with their kids when they're tired and film them in an awful state.
I think it's the same exact thing. I think you're absolutely right. I think that's the same phenomenon. I think that's what we did. We create them first. We create the celebrity. We rise them up amongst us,
yeah.
and then we fucking tear them down.
Yeah. Ooh, that's
it's crazy,
scary,
right?
Huh?
I don't know that it's scary. When I first came upon it, I was scared, but I think we have to kind of take a good hard look at it because it's definitely in us, and it's in us more. I wanted to write a whole chapter on this in my narcissism book, but the publisher wouldn't let me because it's a little heady. But I think the more narcissistic we are, the more injured we are in childhood, the more unregulated aggression, the more we have these kinds of primitive impulses, and the more we head towards those kinds of sacrifices. I mean, I think you know, whenever kids are traumatized, this is the direction it goes. Pre-revolutionary France, Aztecs, you know, where it really gets big.
Wow.
That's where you find this kind of
stuff. I wish you put the chapter in your book. You know, I'll tell you something I heard that's really creepy. I didn't look it up to make sure it's true or not, but somebody told me that if football became illegal and it stopped happening on TV, then all of network television would fall apart because that's where the majority of their money comes from.
Yes,
it's from football.
That's true.
So,
I don't know the majority of the money, but the viewers, lots
the
of viewers
come
there.
Come
yeah.
from football.
Yeah.
So when you consider that football takes young, athletic men
absolutely.
And gives them brain damage.
Yeah. By violently colliding with one another.
Then you see that the roots of network television are growing out of retarded athletes.
Careful.
Wow. Well, I mean, I'm sorry to use that term. I don't know what the right term is. Mentally disabled athletes.
Brain injured athletes.
Forgive me for saying retarded. Yeah. I don't mean that in the.
You mean brain injured athletes.
Forgive. Yeah. I know that is an antiquated term. So forgive me for saying. But brain injured athletes who are, you know, I don't remember his name, but the one who shot himself in the heart. Ugh. Remember that so that they could look at his brain?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Remember that?
Yes, I do.
So if that is not child sacrifice, I don't know what is. We get them like muscular. We get them in shape. We give them the best food.
Well, it's so funny you would say put that element in. Isn't it weird that whenever human sacrifice emerges in a population, it's always the brightest and best that get sacrificed.
Yeah.
We take the virgin. We take the super muscular male. We feed him to the god. We take the intellectuals. We chop their heads off. I mean, why the best? Why do we have to go for the best?
Yeah.
And sacrifice them. It's
such
a weird, from an evolutionary perspective, I try to understand what the hell? Why would we have evolved that?
Well, maybe because just really throwing shit at the wall here.
That's all we're doing.
Yeah, that's all we're doing. But it seems like, okay, so if we kill the greatest member of the tribe, that creates a vacuum where somebody
for
else
our kids.
Yeah, for someone else is gonna have to become
for our
that
kids.
Great. Yeah.
Because that we want our genes to go forward.
Yeah, that's it. So clear it out, let somebody else, and maybe that the next person will get even more powerful and better, and the next person will get more powerful and better. But yeah, that's a really spooky thing. You know the term deep politics?
No.
So deep politics is a term for the aspects of a society that people are not supposed to talk about or look at or think about.
Maybe they can't. They just don't want to. They don't like it.
They don't. Well, yeah, they don't like you. Yeah. It's the stuff where you start talking about it and people say that you don't support the troops.
Right.
Like,
right.
You know, for example, Chris Kyle being a great example of it is if you point out that Chris Kyle, Jesse Ventura successfully sued Chris Kyle because he
punched him.
Fabricated punching him.
Oh.
Yeah, he made it up.
Wow.
So apparently, like, there, you know, a jury found him guilty of making up this story. But if you say that, which I've said on Rogan's podcast, some people, most people are like, thanks for like speaking up about this, because American Sniper is kind of an awful movie in general. And Chris Kyle was somebody who's like, was a liar. Like he lied on TV about punching Jesse Ventura, who was also a veteran. A lot of tweets coming in. Hey, you don't support the troops.
Right, right.
It's like, no. It's not that I don't support the troops. It's that the guy.
It's the same stuff that Bill Maher gets, which is if he raises ambiguities, people assume you're taking a point of view.
Right.
Because I don't think Bill often, he just raises an ambiguity, raises an issue that doesn't sit well. The non-black-white ambiguities in the situation.
Yeah.
Like, you know, what would Chris Kyle look like to an Iraqi? Sort of, he'll just say that, something like that.
Yeah.
How would they think about him? Just wants to, it's a thought experiment.
Yeah. Deep politics.
Yeah, can't do that.
Not supposed to do it.
And I understand why you maybe wouldn't want to do it.
Why?
I can understand that. Because the consequences, we don't know the consequences of that, really. I mean, it could be dangerous. I don't know. I understand where it could be. Black and white thinking lends itself better
to
certain kinds of situations.
Well,
anyway.
I mean,
let's take the guys that we traded for for a prisoner. You know, from an ambiguity standpoint, it's like, all right, we get to save this guy's life. We give some people back. Maybe those guys have a point. Now they're out killing other people.
Sure.
It's like, well, black and white might have been better there.
Well, yeah,
I'm just saying.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, but the way I look at it is not saying stuff. I like to look at the deep politics of like families, you know, because there's exact
awesome.
Same. Yeah, it's awesome.
Same, right?
Same
thing.
Deal. Stuff
people,
you're not supposed to say.
Family myths, family misperceptions, family distortions.
Yeah.
Always.
And there's always someone in a family where if you say the truth.
Not always, but oftentimes.
Sometimes.
In certain kinds of families, particularly like narcissistic structures, when somebody isn't all in, they're all out.
That's it.
That's your boof.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's you get in families the exact same thing you get on Twitter, which is some version of, if you don't like it, leave. That thing, you know, just by saying the truth, just by saying the truth.
But now we're passing judgment on how that works for people. You know what I mean? I really try to stay very objective on everything, even when things seem not intellectually thorough.
Yeah.
If it's working for people, who am I to, you know what I mean? It's like,
That's why you're a doctor, man. You're right. I think there's something cool about a kind of, everything doesn't have to be some extreme revolutionary.
I always worry about getting steeped in ideology or points of view if they're, because there's always different points of view. There's always different ideologies. And it's ultimately much more fruitful to talk about the baby with the elephant head.
Yeah.
I think because that's really the shared human zone.
But, I do think there's something also to be said for yelling at the top of your lungs that Soylent Green is people, too, you know? And
I think
when it comes to the Super Bowl or when it comes to war.
You mean taking a position?
Take a position.
I'm for that. But I'm not sure I should be judging people to take a position. You know what I'm saying?
Or fail to take a position. I just like the idea of the American Sniper, where they make Chris Kyle a flawed being.
Sure.
That suddenly,
like all of us.
Now it's like, okay, now you're showing, hey, look what happens when you get PTSD. I've heard people with PTSD, they just tend to lie. Sometimes they'll just start lying. Is that true?
Well, they become drug addicted and then they start lying. That's what happens.
Man. Ugh, it's 57 minutes in. We got to go. By the way,
we got to do another one now.
We have to do another one. This is so fun chatting with
you.
And also, this is one of the great days of my life because now I get to go do a virtual reality with Dr. Drew, which is pretty badass.
Tell them what we're
going to
do.
We're going Servios. You guys have heard it. I've had them on the podcast before. We're headed over to the Servios holodeck right now so that Dr. Drew can check out.
Have my mind blown.
Have you tried virtual reality?
No, I haven't tried any of this yet.
Yeah, so this is going to be
really
cool.
And then we'll do a pod on that.
That's great. Great. Right. Thank you so much.
You bet.
Okay. Only 10 more presents to wrap. You're almost at the finish line. But first, there, the last one. Enjoy a Coca-Cola for a pause that refreshes.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
Plus, terms and conditions apply.
At CVS, it matters that we're not just in your community, but that we're part of it. It matters that we're here for you when you need us, day or night. And we want everyone to feel welcomed and rewarded. It matters that CVS is here to fill your prescriptions and here to fill your craving for a tasty and, healthy snack. At CVS, we're proud to serve your community because we believe where you get your medicine matters. So visit us at cvs.com or just come by our store. We can't wait to meet you. Store hours vary by location.